Next up on This Week in Law, Larry Martinez, Melissa Force, and Rob Frieden join me. And we're talking space law. Of course, The Force Awakens opens next week. We know you can't wait to see how lawyers are going to affect people's lives in space exploration. That's what we're covering today. We'll look at the laws of Mars and the moon, space junk, space hacking, and much more. By the end of the show, you'll know what IHI and SSA stand for, and the Force will have been with you for a good 90 minutes or so. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson, episode 330, recorded December 2015. North Korean Santa and his jolly sack of nails. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and welcome to This Week in Law. We've got another space law panel on deck for you this week. I'm so excited on the eve of The Force Awakens. It feels like probably the best thing we could possibly do. And the Force is actually going to be with us for the next 90 minutes or so. You can assure yourself of that. Actually, we have three wonderful law professors joining us today, for whom the final frontier is today's frontier. All of them pay attention to various aspects of how our existing law is going to have to shift and accommodate the world of space exploration, and is already doing so. Melissa K. Force is the Force I was referring to. She is a space lawyer and an adjunct professor at the Loyola School of Law here in Southern California. Wonderful to meet you, Melissa.
Nice to meet you. Great to be here.
Also joining us is Larry Martinez. He teaches political science at Cal State University, Long Beach, and studies international governance of space and cyberspace. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, hi, Denise.
Great to see you. Also joining us from Penn State University is Rob Frieden, where he teaches telecommunications law and pays attention to how that is going to play out in the world of space travel and space communications. Hi, Rob. It's great to meet you.
Likewise. Nice to be here.
So we'll get right into it. And you might want to duck, because things have been falling to the Earth from outer space. Something fell just last month. So we're going to start the show talking about space debris and how we deal with that from a legal standpoint. What happened last month is a piece of space junk came plummeting out of the sky in sort of a fiery, spectacular way. Fortunately, it burned up in the atmosphere and parts of it did crash to the ground, I think in the ocean outside of Sri Lanka. No one was quite sure what this was until it landed and could be examined. And then we've got some conclusions now, I think, about how it was just a piece of something that had fallen off up there. And as things sometimes do, you know, what goes up comes down. So that happened. And this was referred to as Space Junk WT, not WTF, 1190F. Oh, there is an F in there for anyone who needs one. We saw that happen last month. So, Melissa, how often does something like this happen exactly?
Well, space debris fall not fairly regularly. It's not a one-off occurrence, and they often fall when nobody's watching, somewhere in the ocean. The ocean comprises about 70% of the planet. So most of the time, they never impact land, and often they're just, you know, people just disregard them. But in terms of debris, there's a lot of stuff floating around in space, orbiting space, and not all of it is what we call space debris. there are other kinds of debris, naturally occurring debris that do enter the atmosphere and burn up, and those are meteorites. So that's distinguished from what we call space junk or space debris, which is by definition, loose definition, anything that's man-made. That's what we're concerned about. So that means that when we talk about space debris, it's something that has been launched or been a component part of something that's been launched sometime in the past, you know, way back from the 60s all the way up until, you know, fairly recently. So just depends on how long it's been in orbit and how high its orbit is and things of that nature. So space debris are all around. They fall down fairly regularly. Often they're burned up in the atmosphere. But if they're large enough, dense enough, they'll survive the atmosphere. And ultimately, like the November 13 piece of debris, will actually impact close to land sometimes. So that's sort of the general idea of space debris. And we've been launching things into space for over 55 years. So it's not surprising that it's starting to get pretty crowded up there. Every time something's launched into space, it includes a rocket. It includes all the parts that are required to propel that satellite or telescope or whatever the payload is, into space. And so rocket stages, one or more rocket stages may ultimately be required to push the satellite into space. And those, unlike things on Earth, what comes up does not come down, because once in space, they don't come back down. They just continue orbiting, even though their use is over with. The rocket bodies finished its job. All of the parts that have been ejected in the process of the launch and propelling the orbit into it, the satellite into its orbit, all those parts all remain in space and become part of what we call space debris. And so that, as you might imagine, the accumulation is pretty extensive by now. After about over 6,600 launches over the course of the past 40 or 50 years, the Air Force, which administers the largest tracking system in the world, the Space Surveillance Network, a worldwide network of space surveillance sensors, radars, telescopes, it tracks anything in space larger than a centimeter, is tracking about 300,000 pieces of space debris. And among those, only about 1,000 are operational satellites that have any hope of being able to maneuver their way out of a collision path with any other satellite or piece of debris. So that means the rest of the 299,000 pieces of debris can't change their collision course even if they wanted to. And so they essentially become hurtling objects that are missiles that can strike other pieces of debris or operational satellites. And the striking other pieces of debris is not nothing, because the concern there is that one piece of debris striking another piece of debris, even if it doesn't have any value to anyone, still in itself creates other fragments, which then all have their own collisional course with other pieces of debris, creating an exponential cascade of collisions that ultimately result in an enormously crowded environment that may make it very difficult for operational satellites to actually use the orbit. And then the problem with, obviously, with debris hitting operational satellites is not just limited to the fact that lots of fragments may be released during the collision, but also the fact that the owner of that satellite is going to lose its money and a very expensive piece of equipment. The people that rely on that piece of equipment for their services are going to have their services disrupted. And so there's a lot at stake in terms of what space debris can do in orbit, as well as the danger of it actually reentering the atmosphere, surviving and falling, heaven help us, on some populated part of the planet, and possibly injuring people or property.
Right. There's a lot to unpack in what you just said. Let's start with the fact that there seems to be space debris in two categories. The part that is orbiting and may orbit for a good long time, if not forever. And the part that, like this piece of, it sounds like experts have concluded it was part of a rocket that came down last month. Sometimes things decay and fall, and in either situation, we've got danger involved, right? While it's orbiting, it could crash into something else that's also orbiting, or be something that needs to be avoided or taken into account. And as you were alluding to, when something falls to Earth, and people just sort of cross their fingers and watch how the orbit is decaying to know where it's going to come down. And yes, we're blessed with a planet that is mostly ocean, but if I think this thing was, let's see, the article here talked about how big it was, something like 6 feet long, and hurtling at great speed toward Earth when it came down. And I'm sure part of it, you know, burned up in the atmosphere, but there was enough left for experts to examine and determine what it was. So how legally do we deal with this situation?
Well, the legal issues are pretty complex, because we're dealing with, for the most part, things that we don't have any control over. And among the legal community, and that's really space lawyers like me and Larry, and for the most part, we have to try to, all across the world, agree on what space debris is in the first place. And as you might imagine, in today's geopolitical climate, with many different kinds of space actors today, in with varying different interests, nobody can really get on the same page in terms of what is going to benefit their country the most. And so as a result, there's not an agreement even as to a definition of space debris beyond the fact that it's artificial, man-made, something launched from Earth. There's no distinction between active spacecraft and space debris, or whether the distinction is between whether an object can no longer perform its intended function, or has no intended function, or has a loss of control, whether it at that point becomes debris. There are experts who disagree that that's enough to put it in the category of useless debris that can be disregarded as something valuable and a space object that can be protected under space law. It may still have, even if it's not functioning, even if it's not controllable, the dead satellite may still have economic value to the launching state. Sometime in the future, they may be able to revive that satellite when technology enables it, or they may be able to harvest some of its pieces in space and use it to rehabilitate other satellites. So it may still have economic value, may also have historical value to a state, just like the moon landing, the rover, and all the equipment that were left on the moon. Those have significant historical value to the United States. So we would have, the U.S. would have a really hard time having all of that described as simply space debris. And it may, an old non-functional reconnaissance satellite may even have continued national security value to a launching state. States don't want anybody near their their secure satellites, either to disrupt them, interrupt their orbit, or get close enough to actually take a look and see what that piece of equipment is comprised of. And so they're very protective of anybody getting close to those satellites. So for a lot of reasons, it's been impossible to come up with a definition of space debris that everybody can agree on. So that's the first line of the first primary legal difficulty that we come to. But even if we assume we overcome the problem of what is space debris legally, the real problem still exists. How do you solve the problem legally about the damage that all of these objects are doing, potentially in collisions with each other and collisions with functional satellites? And one thing that we started doing in the 70s and the 80s is that the heads, the representatives of the space agencies all over the world started getting together and trying to come up with ways that they could mitigate the constant accumulation of space debris that happens with each launch. And they came up eventually in the 90s, started coming together with a list of things that they could do to mitigate accumulation of debris in space. Things like safing old rockets, that exhausting their fuel supply so that they don't explode in and of themselves after they've pushed their satellite into orbit, which had been a real source of explosions in space, generating more space debris, or limiting the amount of debris released during normal operations, you know, altering mission or perhaps the design of rockets and satellites and how they're released, and rules on removing spacecraft and vehicle stages from useful orbits at the end of their life. Things like that into what was ultimately accepted by the United Nations as a group of mitigation guidelines that were adopted by the UN. They're voluntary, which is which many experts see as a problem because any state can disregard them. They don't, and there's no sanction for disregarding them and just continuing with business as usual. But because they've been adopted by the United Nations, they do have the strength of the international community's imprimatur in terms of what is responsible international behavior. And so there's a certain amount of peer pressure that does tend to make more states inclined to observe the guidelines. And a number of states have incorporated those guidelines into their own national laws, as the United States have. But most nations still haven't done that. So the mitigation guidelines have played a big part in reducing the further accumulation of space debris in space, not stopping it, because we haven't stopped launching objects into space. And until we do that, it's just going to still continue to accumulate debris as long as what we're sending up is greater in amount than the amount that just by nature comes back into the atmosphere. So the big problem with mitigation guidelines is that they're non-binding and no one can count on everybody else following them. But the only way to stop and reverse the problem is not through mitigation guidelines, which are very helpful, but the only way to stop and turn that around, the accumulation around, is by removing dangerous objects from orbit. And there have been a number of studies using various models, not all of which are approved and agreed on by all experts in the international community. But they have gained the attention of space lawyers because they demonstrate to some degree the effect that removal of just five large non-functional objects every year can have on the future dissemination of fragments in space and the risk in the entire space environment. And doing that, it could, and that active debris remediation, ADR as it's called, is a way to positively reduce what's out in space and reduce the risk and danger of collisions. But there again, it brings with it many, many legal problems. It also brings with it some very technical problems, political issues as well. Technically, it's very difficult to design a system that will take out another object, even non-functional as it is. There are all kinds of technical devices that have been designed by engineers and scientists to try to do this, ranging from attaching something to the object to slow it down, to get it into a lower orbit so that it's being dragged into the atmosphere, or to throw a net over it or a harpoon on it, or even grapple it and hang on to it just to drag it down into the atmosphere. There are many, many more that I could even talk about here. But right. They're very creative in terms of the ideas that they've come up with. But none of them, as far as we know, is really ready for prime time yet. And that's one of the problems. And even if it were, the financial cost of it is something that right now I don't think many people have a good handle on and how that's going to be financed. But one of the big problems is politically anything that's able to do the things that would be able to incapacitate an object that's orbiting in space can also be used to incapacitate or interfere with a functioning spacecraft, a reconnaissance satellite, or what have you. And it's that dual purpose that those kinds of devices have, the potential for that dual purpose, that really makes many states leery about accepting into a part of remediating the space debris. It's because of the danger that it can also be used not for good, but for evil. So right. We have to get past the political hurdles as well before we even approach the legal hurdles.
Oh my gosh, Melissa, I'm afraid you've just made me so very frightened and depressed.
I don't mean to do that.
We have this huge environmental and safety problem posed by space debris. It's an environmental and safety problem, whether it stays up or comes down, and it doesn't sound like we have great solutions for solving the problem. Larry, can you give any optimism for me?
What Melissa has really very accurately portrayed is the multiple dimensions of this problem. And indeed, it's very daunting to hear about. But let me bring in the political science aspect of this, and that space debris as a problem is really focused on several areas of orbital space. And these are the concentrations of where the problem is greatest. And in many other orbital regions, it's not as much of a problem. But Melissa was alluding to the political problem. Part of the political problem is the fact that these satellites, and in particular communication satellites that are up at geostationary orbit altitudes, the geostationary orbit is an orbit at 22,300 miles above the equator, where a satellite appears to remain stationary in the sky to any user on the surface of the Earth. So this has enormous benefits for communication because you're able then to broadcast television to millions of little dish antennas, and it requires these satellites to remain in one position relative to all those dishes receiving the signals on the Earth. And that's the advantage of the geostationary orbit. The problem is that these satellites are generating a huge amount of revenues for their network operators. And the longer that they're operating in the geostationary orbit, the more money they're making for their owners. The problem is that once the satellites die, and they all have a limited engineering lifetime, once they die, they have to be either boosted out of geostationary orbit up or somehow brought down out of the geostationary orbit altitude. Otherwise, as dead satellites, they will drift in the geostationary orbit, possibly posing a collision danger to the operating satellites there. Or, as Melissa talked about, two dead satellites in the geostationary orbit will have the potential of colliding with each other and generating hundreds, if not thousands, of new pieces of space debris in the geostationary orbit. So it becomes very, very much a question. Let's get all the network operators of the hundreds of satellites that are in the geostationary orbit to sacrifice several months of their station-keeping fuel and boost their satellites up out of the geostationary orbit to a safe higher orbit where they don't pose a risk to other satellites. This requires them to forego several months of revenue that they would otherwise have. And I know we're going to be talking about this later, the International Telecommunication Union, the UN agency in Geneva that allocates the frequencies and the orbital slots for the communication satellites, they already have rules on the book that are supposed to guide the countries and the operators of these satellites to boost them out of geostationary orbit. However, when we look at the record, is that only about half or less than half of the operators of geostationary satellites are actually doing that. So we're looking at an increasing problem of congestion in the geostationary orbit. And this is a issue that the International Telecommunication Union has taken up. But as Melissa said, is that there's no real binding effect. That is, who is going to enforce this? And until there is actually some kind of a real penalty imposed on countries or operators that do not, let's say, remove their satellites from geostationary orbit, we're going to have a very low compliance rate like we do now. The other area of real concern is low Earth orbit. So instead of being up at geostationary, which is 22,300 miles, low Earth orbit is in the first few hundred miles, about the orbital altitude that the International Space Station is located at. And here you have, as Melissa was talking about, a very high number of satellites. Many of these are reconnaissance satellites. Some can be scientific. Some, like the International Space Station, are big users of these low Earth orbital altitudes. And in fact, the International Space Station, on average, every few weeks has to do a maneuver to avoid a piece of space debris. Mm-hmm. So this huge International Space Station that's the size of a soccer field has to use its rockets to boost itself out of the path of what they anticipate to be a close flyby of a piece of space debris. And this illustrates the problem. What we're looking at coming up is at these low Earth orbital altitudes our plans, for instance, and right next to my university in Long Beach, Sir Richard Branson is planning on building a rocket factory and building rockets that he wants with his customers to put 4,000 low Earth orbiting communication satellites into orbit. The United States has programs for encouraging universities, research labs, and so forth to produce little nano satellites, little CubeSats, hundreds of them, to be put into low Earth orbit to do scientific research and so forth. The problem is, who is going to enforce the rule that these satellites are all going to be safely deorbited within what they call the 25-year window? They want to establish guidelines so that these satellites in low Earth orbit in this very valuable place of the orbital region do not pose a penalty on the future satellites that want to use the same area. Since all these satellites have a limited engineering lifetime, it really becomes imperative now to ensure that when somebody wants to put up 4,000 communication satellites, that all these satellites then are going to have the ability to deorbit themselves and remove themselves as a potential source of a space debris problem.
So who is going to enforce that?
That's the 64,000 satellite question, because the problem with international law is the fact that it, in contrast to domestic law, it takes place in an anarchic environment because there is no world government. There's no one out there who has the, let's say, the monopoly of coercive authority, as we say in political science, to enforce the rules. So as Melissa was saying, is that these are, by and large, non-binding rules without real enforcement mechanisms in back of them. Of course, the ultimate enforcement mechanism is that since all countries have an interest in maintaining the openness of space, and the international treaties stipulate that outer space is to be open to all countries. If we pollute it with lots of space debris, it means that really we're shooting ourselves in the foot. And especially the United States, since we are by far the country that uses outer space the most, and we are then most vulnerable to any disruptions in outer space, we have the strongest interest in maintaining a space debris-free orbit, orbital region. Other countries, as they realize their dependency on outer space, we can expect then that the enforcement mechanism is an enlightened self-interest. However, that does not remove the free rider. And as I was talking about up in the geostationary, if I'm a network operator and I want to make the most money possible for my shareholders, I'm going to want to operate that satellite till it dies, because every month that I sacrifice in station-keeping fuel to boost it up to the other higher altitude is going to cut into my bottom line. And so the ITU has been looked at, you know, ever since the space age dawned, as probably the most likely agency to exert some kind of enforcement mechanism, because all satellite operators are utterly dependent on the allocation of frequencies and the orbital slots for geostationary. So I think the ITU is probably the place to look for in the near term for anything coming close to space debris policy enforcement on the international level.
Rob, can you add anything to that, since a great deal of what is up there is facilitating our terrestrial communications and entertainment?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to compliment my colleagues for being very conservative in terms of the use of acronyms and buzzwords. I think if you had Washington or military types, you'd hear one acronym after another. I'm going to introduce a couple of phrases for good measure to maybe hopefully not complicate the matter. And again, my colleagues here have done a really, really good job of trying to clarify. I am going to start by saying, well, you know, if I were an economist or a political economist, I'd say this is all about incentives because the disincentive is something called the tragedy of the commons. And that gets back to sort of Grangelands where if government owns it and says you all come, you can bring your animals to graze at no cost. The problem might be that you end up with overgrazing. You don't have a price mechanism. You don't have a allocational mechanism, a pricing mechanism. So there's a tendency for overconsumption. That happens in Las Vegas at buffets, and the concept of overconsumption. So the tragedy of commons in the orbital arc, both for geostationary satellites and low Earth orbiting satellites, is that if parties don't have incentives to conserve or to clean up their act, then you're going to have congestion, which becomes an increasing problem. So the economist says, well, let's either use a carrot or a stick. The stick would be an enforcement mechanism, but the carrot would be incentives. And we're seeing that in terms of cost savings, there are moves afoot with some of the new entrepreneurial launch companies to try to reuse the rocket. You can perhaps reduce a launch that might cost $100 million into double digits or maybe even single digits by having reusable parts. So instead of having rockets just enter into the commons and become more of a congestion problem, reuse them and control them so that they land at a known location and don't strike the Earth with such force that they can't be reused. So one incentive would be cost savings. Another one would be, you know, using the good offices of the International Telecommunication Union, you could revise the rules by saying, well, you have this very valuable parking place, an orbital slot. You can continue to use that orbital slot for a replacement satellite, provided you deorbit that satellite in a very proper manner, good offices, best practices. I was looking in preparation for our discussion and came up with a new word that talks to deorbiting or moving the satellite into a place not likely to exacerbate the problem. And the word is passivating. So that one's new for me, but you want to put it outside of an actively orbited location into one that's not as valuable and as congested. As Larry said, you want to keep the station keeping fuel to propel it either out of orbit or accelerate it so that it burns up. But passivate is the positioning of satellites into a location where it won't cause a problem. So the third thing is maybe you have a bounty. The bounty would be that if you practice the best practices, if you engage in best practices, if you collect a lot of garbage, maybe there could be a mechanism for compensating you. There's all sorts of gee whiz technology involving sales, S-A-I-L-S, not solar, mm-hmm. Sales, C-E-L-L-S, sales, to sort of collect the garbage and either bring it down or bring it up. But I note Melissa's comment about this technology that is sort of like garbage collecting could also be actively engaged in cyber warfare and collecting perfectly operational satellites. So it's a real mess, and one that economists would love to say, well, it's just a matter of incentives. But if the carrot isn't there and if the stick isn't there, then you're in this kind of potential where everybody suffers through the tragedy of the commons.
Right, which brings us to states that might not play so nicely politically with their fellow nation states, such as North Korea. Can you tell us, Larry, what your concerns are there?
Yeah, several years ago, North Korea managed to launch a satellite into orbit and received a really immediate condemnation by other countries, particularly the United States and other spacefaring countries, in part because North Korea was held under sanctions under the missile technology control regime. And there was a real concern that what North Korea was using this satellite test was to demonstrate its ability to launch and carry a nuclear warhead under very, very high technological requirements for very long distances. And so this naturally raised on the nuclear side immediate concerns because of the saber rattling of the North Korean leadership. But there is another element here that is receiving increasing scrutiny, and that is that a rogue nation like North Korea, even if it only has very primitive rocket technology, could nonetheless have the potential to wreak havoc on literally trillions of dollars worth of space assets by launching a debris cloud up in outer space. And this has been postulated by science fiction writers and so forth that to incapacitate, for instance, the global positioning system satellites. These are the navigation satellites that the U.S. military and other countries and all of us using smartphones depend on to find our way on Google Maps, is that actually North Korea could incapacitate satellites such as the GPS by launching a very primitive rocket, but with a huge sack of nails in it that would be put into orbital altitude to GPS. And eventually, these very small pieces of debris would start hitting perfectly healthy satellites that we depend on. And so this, in part, underlines the international concern that space debris has to be addressed with a great deal more, focus by the international community. For instance, right now we have a conference of parties, climate change conference going on in Paris. They're dealing with pollution of the atmosphere. Here is where we have actually a pollution problem in outer space, and it requires the same kind of high-level attention that is presently being given to climate change. And I think the North Korean example was one where a country could claim that it was conducting a satellite test, which is fully legal under the Outer Space Treaty and other international legal instruments talking about outer space. But at the same time, as Melissa and Rob were talking about, is that there is also that dual use element to it. And I think that the weaponization of space debris, and here's, and Rob, here's another word. I want to thank you for passivitating to add to my vocabulary. Weaponization of space debris is something that is going to be bouncing from the pages of science fiction into the nightmares for policymakers of the outer space environment.
Right. Well, there's an acronym that you threw my way at the as we were prepping for the show, Larry, that maybe we should get to here, SSA, or Space Situational Awareness. It seems to be the government's strategy for not only tracking all the little tiny CubeSats, but making sure they know that, and now I'm going to have this image in my mind throughout the holidays when we go to track Santa with NORAD and my child asks me, oh, look, there's Santa flying through. And I'm going to be thinking, no, that's North Korean Santa and he's got his sack of nails. So how is space situational awareness poised to deal with what you've been raising here, Larry.
Yeah, well, I would probably like to throw this also to Melissa because she was talking about it in terms of one of the techniques for space debris remediation. That is, where satellites are able to detect a threat to them. That is, if an object is coming close to them, space situational awareness means that the satellite actually has sensors that can detect a threat, be it another satellite, be it a piece of debris or so forth that could possibly come up to it. This is almost like a James Bond movie where the, and I forget which James Bond movie it was, but where the satellite, the good satellite is attacked by the bad satellite physically. It just comes up alongside. And like Melissa was talking about, it could throw a net over the satellite and, you know, do something illegal with it.
Right. Melissa, can you bring us further up to speed on space situational awareness?
Well, very, very general. Of course, it's collision avoidance, which is sort of the main object of having a good space situational awareness. As I mentioned earlier, we have the space surveillance network that the U.S. Maintains and has a lot of other folks also adding to its data store, including commercial operators as well, the Space Data Association. So the Air Force keeps tabs on the 300,000 or so pieces of debris and adjusts its data, its two-line element data, as to the positioning and the trajectory for each of those pieces to determine within a certain percentage of certainty whether or not it's on a collision path with something important, a functional satellite. Needless to say, given the distances involved, there's a huge margin of error. So they don't take lightly the recommendation that the ISS or any operational satellite move its position, because they just don't have a huge amount of confidence that that's going to be precise enough in terms of letting the operator know exactly, you know, where to move it, which direction to move it. And because these kinds of things are imprecise and they're affected by things like space weather and, you know, anomalies in the atmosphere and that sort of thing. So collision avoidance is a very difficult subject with the ISS, because there are humans on board. They're much more likely to have the ISS take evasive action, just because the mere risk, no matter how small it is, that human life could be endangered, is enough to have them make that call. But it takes an enormous amount of energy and coordination of a lot of people on the ground in order to do that.
Right. Rob, do you have anything to add on the space situational awareness front? Is this something that telecommunications satellites are starting to build in?
Well, perhaps we could do a case study and sort of assess the legal implications of an actual collision involving a communications satellite. It happened in 2009. An Iridium low Earth orbiting satellite collided with a decommissioned functionally disabled and non-maneuverable Russian Cosmos satellite. And I'm just looking at the background on these two satellites. They are substantial vehicles. The Iridium satellite 33 weighed in at 1,518 pounds, and the Cosmos 2251 weighed in at 1,980 pounds. And they collided at right angles to each other at roughly the speed of 22,300 miles per hour. So that's quite an impact. That's not a fender bender. And pretty much disabled. Thank you so much. You're a lovely group. Iridium satellite. And practically speaking, this particular satellite was nearing end of life. But let's assume for the sake of our discussion, it had just been launched. And as Larry mentioned, these are very valuable assets. Iridium provide, and I should disclose that I before I became a professor, I worked early with Motorola on this project. Iridium provides slow speed data and voice communications anytime, anywhere, and truly anytime, anywhere, and probably better connectivity is at the North and South Pole than at the equator. It was not successful initially because of the proliferation of terrestrial cellular communications, but in lots of places in the world where there aren't cell phone towers, Iridium has carved out a niche. So these are valuable satellites, expensive satellites, and lo and behold, this Iridium satellite is on a known orbit and minding its own business, and along comes this decommissioned disabled satellite. Sometimes the adjective is derelict. I like that concept, derelict. It's derelict in the sense that the owner of the satellite didn't decommission it and move it out into a passive piece of real estate. So the law, the 1967 Outer Space Treaty and the 1972 Liability Convention are the applicable documents, intergovernmental documents. And they don't really identify with any clarity, sort of empirically, who's at fault here. Basically, the documents say that the launching state is responsible for objects on orbit. Okay, well, the United States government, as agent, I guess, for private corporations and as the signatory, is responsible for the Iridium satellite, and similarly, the USSR at the time, Russia, is responsible for that satellite. So then it becomes a question of, okay, you're responsible for the two satellites. They collided. Stuff happens. But in point of fact, you know, Iridium was in a known, disclosed, registered orbit, and this other satellite was sort of wobbling about because it reached end of life and was no longer in a sort of predictable orbit. And even if it were predictable, there's, as Melissa says, there's some uncertainty as to how that that orbit starts to decay and degrade, and the satellite moves closer and closer into the Van Allen belt and possibly picking up speed and vaporizing. So, who's responsible for this collision? It almost gets to a kind of old school tort argument that, well, Iridium had the last clear chance to avoid the collision because it had some station keeping and maneuverability to sort of avoid the collision. But then the question becomes, well, how much time did Iridium actually have before the satellite comes careening into it? And in point of fact, well, maybe the responsible best practices would have been for the Russians to have put this satellite into a passive location, or kicked it out of orbit entirely, or sped it up so that it would vaporize. The long and short of it is that because the Iridium satellite was nearing end of life, and because of the ambiguity, they sort of agreed to disagree, and there was no litigation and no sort of international incident brought upon by this particular conflict. But I think it raises a good case study of, well, what do you do when you've got a newly launched satellite, with great value, and a decommissioned satellite that can't control itself and can't be maneuvered plows into the other satellite. If we were on the Earth and this were automobiles, and I'm parked or I'm in a red light stopped, and somebody rear ends me, well, the ticket and the liability is going to go to the party that could have controlled their vehicle and avoided the collision. So it's a good example of space situational awareness, perhaps helping anticipate a problem and possibly leading to some maneuvering. But then it raises the question of, well, if only one party can maneuver, are they obligated by best practices, by treaty to avoid the collision. Certainly, if somebody is jaywalking, I have to brake or try to maneuver around the jaywalker and not rest on the legal principle that they were violating the law. But on the other hand, it strikes me that the sort of Russian satellite operator got a complete pass by having no responsibility on grounds that they had a derelict satellite that had no maneuverability.
Could I jump in here?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. Just to follow up on what Rob is saying is that when you look at the liability treaty, however, there are actually two spheres of liability that differ. And so what we're talking about here is liability caused by the collision of two objects in outer space. And this is a fault-based liability. So it, in order to assign liability, it is going to be assigned by a finding of fault on one of the parties. Yeah. In terms of damage to the Earth or any objects in the air, for instance, if there's an aircraft, and Denise, you showed the picture of the piece of space debris entering the atmosphere. Let's say you're an airline captain flying an airliner and you see a piece of debris coming your way. If it hits your airplane and causes damage to your airplane, that owner of the space debris has, under the international treaty, the liability treaty, an absolute liability. And there's no requirement to find fault, so that you can't then say that the pilot of the airliner had the last chance to avoid the piece of space debris and therefore clear the owner of the piece of space debris. In other words, there's two then realms of liability, and they differ in that regard.
As Larry was saying, the liability convention would apply to collisions in orbit as opposed to on Earth or in the air, as with the airliner. But that's the very difficulty in the liability convention is that it's a fault-based standard in terms of determining who is, who caused it, who has to pay for and be legally responsible for any damages. It's very difficult to prove fault when there's zero guidance from the Liability Convention or any of the other treaties, or the Outer Space Treaty, the Constitution of Space Law, if you will. So the Liability Convention has never been invoked in the history of its existence, except for possibly once. And I think my friend Henry Herzfeld, who was on this program a couple months ago, said something about the Cosmos 954 landing in northern Canada, which thankfully didn't harm anyone, but it did do significant environmental damage. In that instance, Canada demanded that Russia pay the environmental damages, which were very significant, and Russia refused. Ultimately, they eventually settled. Russia paid some money, not all the money that Canada asked for, but that was the one time that the Liability Convention may have actually been used. So right now, in terms of how we would prove fault, what weight the various factors would be given in the context of space is an iffy proposition, and nobody really knows how that's going to play out in an arbitration or a legal proceeding or in a national court if it ultimately ends up there.
Well, now seems like a good time to go ahead and put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We embed these phrases into the show in case you are listening for professional credit, either in the legal field or another field, and you need to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened. And I think, thanks to you, Larry, we're going to make the first passphrase for this show, satellite eating satellite. From IRC and I have concluded it's from You Only Live Twice. Yes. That will, yes, I think we have a photo, maybe. queued up of that. I certainly have the visual of it in my mind. So if Kara, you've got the photo in the studio queued up, just throw it up anytime. Doesn't have to be now. There we go. Oh, it's just a little one. There is the monster. That's exactly what came to mind when you mentioned that. All right, so that's our first passphrase. And we may as well take a break now and thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law before we get back into it and discuss the new commercial space law that was just passed in the United States and a whole bunch of other interesting things, such as what the heck Matt Damon meant by calling himself the first space pirate in The Martian. But we wouldn't be doing the show without the help of FreshBooks, so we want to take some time and thank them and make sure that you are familiar with FreshBooks, particularly if you're a freelancer or you run a small business. Chances are, if so, your least favorite part is rummaging through receipts, trying to keep track of your expenses, creating, formatting, and sending invoices, and the worst, tracking down customers who don't pay you on time. FreshBooks is the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. I use FreshBooks in my law practice. It's a wonderful tool. It makes it so seamless for me at the end of the month when it's time to capture the work that I've done. Really, there's nothing to do at that point because with FreshBooks, I'm able to capture that time as I go along and do work for clients. And then all I need to do at the end of the month is quickly put together a very professional looking, very clear and accurate record of that time and get it out to my clients by email, which let's face it, that's how they want to get it. That's how you're more likely to get it to them quickly and in a timely manner. So you're not responding. They're not responding to work that you've done weeks or months in the past, and they've forgotten about it at this point when you're invoicing them. FreshBooks makes it quick, professional, seamless, and you can create and send out your invoices in minutes. Also, a new feature of FreshBooks, you can get paid up front, as a lot of attorneys do. Sometimes we get a retainer to operate on. A lot of other businesses do that too. A deposit that then you can bill against the deposit as you do your work. That's now enabled in FreshBooks. No more covering costs out of pocket or waiting until the end of a project to get paid. FreshBooks lets you organize your expenses easily. You can track your time almost instantly, even on mobile devices. And with their automated late payment reminders, you can avoid those awkward emails or phone calls to late paying clients. With FreshBooks automated customer reviews report, you can see all of your reviews in one place, then easily post them on your website if you're so inclined. Plus, FreshBooks just announced their new card reader. Now you can easily accept credit cards wherever business takes you, quickly and securely, right from your phone in less than a minute. FreshBooks card reader is EMV chip card enabled. That's the new standard in the US. If you're seeing the new card readers in stores, that's what that's all about. And FreshBooks accepts it too. And it works right out of the box. Just open your invoice from the FreshBooks app, plug in the reader, and dip the chip or swipe the stripe. You'll wonder why you didn't start with FreshBooks sooner. If you have questions, help is free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks' award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to FreshBooks.com/twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. And thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, I mentioned the fact that we have a new law here in the U.S. that was just enacted. It was sort of quietly signed into law by President Obama. It's called the U.S. Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act, and it does a bunch of things. Why don't we start with you, Melissa, and have you bring us up to speed about this law.
Okay, great. I have clients who are impacted by this. So this is something that was not so quiet to me when it happened. Actually, it was preceded by a couple false starts in the past couple years, but ultimately was passed and signed, as you said, last month. And the part of the bill that seems to be receiving the most attention is perhaps the smallest part, and that's the part that has to do with space resources. and which basically says any U.S. citizen who obtains space resources can possess, own, transport, use, and sell space resources once they obtain them. And Congress passed this law because the Outer Space Treaty, our Constitution of Space Law, requires states to pass national laws regarding regulating the non-governmental activities of its nationals in space. So because this is a commercial movement that is gaining momentum, the government sought to be ahead of the actual technological ability to carry this out and have regulations in place before that happened. So there's some, if you've read the papers, there are some people who believe it's illegal, and then there are some people who believe it's illegal. And let me just start by saying that these two factions in the space law community both have respected experts on their side on the issue of whether the exploitation of natural resources from a celestial body is legal. I'm on the side that believes space mining is legal under international law, and that side probably carries the weight of authority. A couple of days ago, the president of the International Institute of Space Law published an op-ed piece in Space News on this very subject. And over the past few weeks, there have been other experts that have also published op-ed pieces basically saying the same thing. But it's important to understand that the other faction does have well-respected scholars and a good argument up to a point. So to give you an idea of what the disagreement is about, it's very basically, I'm giving a broad brush treatment here, but the Outer Space Treaty, the very first provision, Article 1, says the use of celestial bodies shall be carried out for the benefit and in the interest of all countries, irrespective of their degree of economic or scientific development, and shall be in the province of all mankind, and free for use by all states without discrimination on a basis of equality. So that sounds like a kumbaya approach to sharing space resources. And in fact, when this was negotiated, there were only two countries that had the hope of even being able to do any space mining. So you can understand how the rest of the states at the time wanted to preserve somehow their right in the future when they had the economic and technological ability to develop a means to mine any resources that they might actually have preserved in the treaty their right to do so. Then Article 2, the second article in the Space Treaty, says celestial bodies cannot be appropriated by anyone. And those on the other side of the argument, those who say space mining is illegal, stop there. They say basically that since space resources come from a celestial body, therefore celestial bodies cannot be owned by anyone, mining them is illegal. But on the face of it, that looks like a pretty reasonable argument. But there's an ambiguity. Is exploiting natural resources an allowable use of space? So we need to interpret what the Outer Space Treaty intends as a use under the rules of contract interpretation, which lawyers sort of naturally do. Subsequent state practice is very important. And then it becomes important to understand that at the time the Outer Space Treaty was being negotiated, when it was being negotiated, the members of the UN Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space already contemplated that there were going to be follow-on treaties for liability, for registration of space objects, for astronauts, and for how the natural resources were going to be exploited from the moon and other celestial bodies. So at that time, they absolutely believed that those resources were going to be exploited. And in fact, in the 70s, almost the entire length of the 70s, from 70 or 71 until 1979, they negotiated a treaty whose primary purpose was to determine how those benefits of mined space resources that were removed celestial bodies would be allocated, not whether they could be allocated, but why, how they were going to do so. And the Mund agreement, I just want to make clear, my discussion of that has nothing to do whether it's binding on any country or not, any country other than the very few that actually ratified it, because it's not binding on the U.S. or Russia or any other spacefaring nation. The importance of the Mund agreement is that the language it contains was negotiated for 9 years, and it explicitly makes it clear that all these countries that negotiated it expected that the natural resources were going to be exploited, taken, removed from the celestial body, and would be treated differently legally than the celestial body itself. So, you know, putting aside the details of just how those benefits would or wouldn't be split up, which is a big reason why many countries decided not to ratify the treaty, it's illogical to believe that all the states of the UN would have negotiated for 9 years without anyone piping up and saying, hey, what we're doing here is totally illegal under the Constitution of space law. Nobody did that. And it's not surprising because they all realized that anything dug up from celestial bodies was going to be treated differently than the celestial bodies themselves, which could not be owned by anyone. So the consensus of the UN that it's proper to determine rules about how and not whether those resources would be exploited shows that they intended all along to treat the resources of celestial bodies different than the celestial bodies themselves and permit the states or the entities who are acting by permission of the states from which they come to own them, use them, sell them, transport them, everything that the new Space Act says that they can do. And if there's any doubt about that, the one kind of natural resource that we have actually managed to bring back from the moon or any celestial body is moon rocks. And over the past 45 years, we've been selling them, exchanging them, auctioning them, all as if they're personal property owned and controlled by whatever entity it is or individual who's doing the selling or trading or auctioning of those moon rocks. And no objection by any state has been made to that process. Those are natural resources obtained from the moon. Nobody's objected to that. So there's a certain amount of international law that's been developed by subsequent state action. And that is why there's this divide. People on my side who say that space mining is legal, point out that it's been the natural resources were expected to be treated differently all along from celestial bodies.
Okay. First, I should ask Larry and Rob, do you agree with that interpretation that as folks have acted on the International Space Treaty, that we've evinced an intent that natural resources are not?
I'll chime in just very quickly. The sort of practical court of public opinion mindset would be, possessions 9/10 or more of the law. So you've got the sort of layperson's understanding that if you take it, it's yours. And we in the United States have a history of maybe sort of jumping the gun. I teach an internet law course, and we were talking about cyber. Squatting, and I asked my students if they remembered their U.S. history about the Sooners of Oklahoma, and of course, no one knew. But the state of Oklahoma, Indian Territory, was staked out in advance of maybe any legal authorization to do so. So possession is 9/10 of the law. I think also going to sort of case precedent and analogy, if you look at the law of the sea, you can't own parts of the ocean, or you can't own Antarctica, or you can't own the North Pole, you can't own aspects of the earth, but you can exploit what's available. So there might be on the floor of the sea magnesium nodules, and it's not part of the territorial ownership of any particular country. It's in the high seas. It's actually on the floor of the ocean. It's available for anyone to take possession of. So you might create a dichotomy between non-ownership of the asteroid, but ownership of assets that could be derived and transported from the asteroid.
Yeah, and let me just add to that is that the Moon Treaty was being developed at the same time that the Law of the Sea Treaty was being developed. So as Rob and Melissa have talked about, is that there are these negotiations going on in parallel. And as Rob mentioned, the deep seabed nodules of manganese and other elements that were thought to be a huge reservoir of wealth, many thousands of feet deep on the deep seabed, was declared the common heritage of mankind, as the Moon Treaty also declared the moon and other celestial bodies the common heritage of mankind. And so this, as Melissa was talking about, raises the issue of what is then the legal status in terms of how profits from any entity either mining the deep seabed or extracting resources, let's say, off an asteroid. And this is becoming actually reality because the Obama administration and its national space policy has a asteroid recovery mission where they want to grab a space rock and bring it to the lunar orbit, and they would then actually begin to take this asteroid rock apart. And so if they find something valuable there, what is then the legal status of that, what they find? And I think what we're discussing here is, for instance, is the Moon Treaty applicable law if it's only ratified, I think, by 11 states and none of them spacefaring states? Does it have the same limited legal applicability or validity as does the fact that the United States never ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty, primarily because of the common heritage of mankind objections over the deep seabed nodules? And so this is a very relevant discussion. And let me just raise one more element of it in terms of sovereignty or appropriation of space resources. The International Telecommunication Union allocates slots in the geostationary orbit that are very, very valuable. So if you have a satellite and you're able to put it into a slot up there in the geostationary orbit, you are essentially using a space resource, which is that location in space. If you have a satellite that has a lifetime of 25 years, and what they're finding is that many of these satellites, if they're used efficiently, have a very, very long engineering lifetime, does a 25-year engineering lifetime constitute an appropriation that would then violate the precepts under the Outer Space Treaty? So these are some of the elements then that go into this discussion that we're talking about in terms of the appropriation of outer space resources.
I have something that I think can help help add or at least shed light on at least the first part of Larry's question, and that is how would, if indeed they're successful in their mission and recovering any sort of valuable resources, how is everything going to be divvied up and split? Is there going to be any kind of an obligation to share the wealth of derived from those resources? And the short answer is no. And the Moon Treaty is not going to be binding. The procedures that are, the detailed procedures that are set out in the Moon Treaty are not going to be binding. The states who are likely to actually be able to accomplish this feat are not going to want to abide by the Moon Treaty, and they, in fact, don't have to. What will control is the 1996 Space Benefits Declaration. That is the result of decades-long argument between the various factions in the international community about this very question. How should these space benefits, what I read you earlier, the portion of the Outer Space Treaty that says that the use and benefits of space should be for all countries, not just those who are economically and technically able to make it there first and, you know, claim first possession rights. And that was negotiated into the treaty. So the developing countries want to preserve their right to actually have something left by the time they're able to make it there. So there's been this, but of course, developed countries who are actually able to put together the financial resources to actually carry this out naturally do not want to have to split the profits because they're taking all the risk, and the other countries have no risk. So for decades, there's been this big argument, and it was finally resolved. This Article 1 issue about space benefits was resolved in the 1996 Space Declaration, Space Benefits Declaration. And it basically says that every state is free to determine how and the extent to which it will share the benefits obtained from outer space. Now, it sounds a little bit one-sided the way I'm saying it, and I'm obviously oversimplifying it, but it's actually what the past 15 years have shown, that it's been actually very beneficial for all concerned. As a result of the Space Benefits Declaration, the states that have been able to take advantage of remote sensing and all the other resources from their activities in outer space have shared lots of information with developing countries that have augmented their ability to manage agricultural resources, to commit data and information for the purpose of studying climate change and for disaster relief, all kinds of things that have inured to the benefit of all countries, not just those who are actually able to harness the resources from the states. So my best bet is that if something like that happens, if somebody's actually able to get their hands on a natural resource that does hold some value, they will be able to keep the monetary benefit of that and use some creative way, make the benefit of that maybe by sharing some technology or contributing to the database of information that all states can use to supplement their own space development programs. There are many ways that obtaining those resources can be also used to the benefit of other states that don't involve splitting up the monetary rewards for obtaining those. Resources.
I think
sorry.
We've got.
Go ahead, Rob.
Just two analogies that might corroborate Melissa's point there, and they both involve satellites. One was a move afoot of primarily developing nations to have what's called an a priori allocation of satellite parking places, and what that would do is basically reserve for developing countries, orbital slots, parking places for satellites that would lie vacant until such time, if ever, when that country might have the financial resources to invest in actually occupying the slot. That sort of a priori planning didn't get a lot of granularity because, in point of fact, you'd end up having vacant scarce orbital slots that might lie vacant for a long, long time, if not in perpetuity. What sense does it make when those satellite slots are scarce in the first place, but also could be activated sooner rather than later. And there are all sorts of spillover, positive networking externalities to get back into the economic realm. The second analogy was a relatively short period of time during which equatorial countries in particular were saying, well, if satellites are going to reside 22,300 miles above our country and we own from hell to heaven, then they're actually trespassing of a sort. And that gets to the question of, you know, when does Earth stop and space begin? And what sort of ownership rights do equatorial countries have in terms of something lying above them, albeit 22,300 miles high? So there are at least two analogies involving satellites where there was at least a recognition that developed countries having the economic wherewithal to have a head start certainly could capture the lion's share of the benefits, but that some of those benefits would flow and accrue for the betterment of society and the world.
All right. We've already had the specter of the North Korean debris cloud of nails lurking out there as people are looking to exploit lunar resources and other resources floating around the solar system. I suppose we wouldn't have completely covered the whole range of things we could be frightened of if we didn't also talk about the hacking that could be involved in trying to carry out these endeavors. Another acronym we'll throw your way and have our experts explain here is IHI, International Harmful Interference. So certainly, you know, in addition to physical damage, probably interfering with space operations in a technological way is probably more cost effective, perhaps easier, and maybe more effective to thwarting someone else's achievements, if that's what you're out to do. So, Rob, why don't you tell us about IHI and where things stand on preventing it?
Right. Well, I think we get back to at least an analysis using history and analogy, and this is where the International Telecommunication Union conflict resolution and conflict avoidance comes into play. When you look at satellite jamming or satellite interference, there really are precursors in terms of broadcast jamming and broadcast interference. Not so long ago, we had, you know, sort of geopolitical politics where broadcasts to Cuba, for example, would be jammed, or broadcasts in Europe, Radio Free Europe, would be jammed by the Russians. And there was basically efforts on the part of countries to prevent broadcasts from being received across borders without authorization. Well, broadcasts, transmissions and satellite transmissions know no borders, and almost by definition, they're international and transborder. So our analysis can start by looking at the rules, the International Telecommunication Union rules. And again, there's an enforcement problem. Some of the high-level documents, intergovernmental documents, have the status of treaties, but you know, how do you enforce a treaty? The bottom line is there is a kind of first filed, first registered, first protected type of model here. So that if you have a broadcast transmitter that you want to operate on a particular frequency and it's consistent with the regulations that have identified that particular spectrum as usable for broadcasting or for satellite, fixed satellite service, mobile satellite service, you have what is known as primary status. Primary status means you have a right to operate on that frequency in that orbital slot without interference. In fact, you can claim that right in perpetuity so long as you're, you know, transmitting on that frequency. That means that subsequent operators who want to operate on that frequency can't, or they have to find ways to avoid interference. So The issue here is one of interference avoidance unintentionally and intentionally, and the International Telecommunication Union rules are such that basically countries that are signatories to the organic documents of the ITU make an affirmative assertion or affirmative agreement, accession to terms in those agreements that say we'll respect the allocations and the sovereign right of countries to use frequencies and to use devices like satellites, even though the use of those frequencies cross over borders.
All right. I wanted to round out the show, and sorry that we dropped my video, but we did along the way there. So I'm sorry my lips aren't moving if you're watching the video. To wrap up the show here and put our final MCLE passphrase into the show, and for anyone who needs more information about requesting MCLE or other professional credit for the show, go to wiki.twit.tv and find our page there, This Week in Law, and there's more information there for you. The second phrase is going to be space pirate, and we alluded to the movie The Martian. And the character Mark Watney there has a great line at one point where he is embarking on commandeering a NASA spacecraft called the Ares IV. And because of these legal considerations, we've been discussing how ownership in space gets complicated and there are treaties that govern it. According to him in the movie, he has to commandeer the Ares IV, and that technically makes him a pirate, and not just any kind of pirate, a space pirate. Larry, do you agree with him?
Yeah, it's a great movie, and I hope it wins a lot of Academy Awards. But in terms of its adherence to space law, and I know that Melissa has written about this, is that under the liability and registration conventions, as well as the Outer Space Treaty, is that what Matt Damon is saying is not really accurate, because you never, the country, the United States, launching this mission, never loses ownership or responsibility for that space object. And so there's no, let's say, interruption in the ownership. So Matt Damon never really becomes the owner of that spaceship. And so he's not really a pirate. He's still a NASA employee as he's driving across Mars.
That's what I was kind of thinking. Melissa, do you agree with Larry here?
Yeah, but and I do understand that attempt to transport an analog from the law of the sea into space law, unfortunately, that hasn't been accepted, although other law of the sea analogs have been imported. That particular one hasn't. I've been writing a book with a chapter on piracy and the use of that particular analog in space law. So I know a little bit about this, but it's not very, very accurate, that that line, although it is a great laugh. So
yes, I think if I were marooned on Mars, it might make it easier to think of myself as a pirate as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you're interested in getting to Mars or anywhere else in space, that is where our resource and tip of the week are designed to take you. A resource of the week is a space tourism timeline that tracks through all of the private efforts to get you and I, and actually I don't think it's you and I, but it's people at this point with bucket loads of money, into space to go ahead and enjoy space from a leisure standpoint. Rounding out with at the end of the timeline, I think we alluded to already in the show, if we didn't, we've been remiss in not talking about Blue Origin, talking about getting some of the space debris out of there. Amazon managed to launch and land the first reusable rocket ship in history on November 23rd, 2015. Again, the space tourism drive continues. And if you're interested in the history of that, if you go to our discussion points for the show at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, you'll see everything that we've talked about today. including this piece from inverse.com by Sam Blum, which is the space tourism timeline. And then our tip of the week is how to get you to space. If you're just, if you've got those pockets full of money, bucket loads of money, is you're going to need a few of them, I think. You know, the pricing at this point is fairly fluid and unknown. But there are a couple of companies out there that will take you to space, or at least give you a space-like experience. The first one, the one that's a little bit more attainable for folks, is by the Zero Gravity Corporation, and that's going up in the Vomit Comet. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Larry?
Yeah, this is the, as you said, Denise, this is the perfect little stocking stuffer for somebody to give this Christmas to a loved one. I'm not sure that they would, well, I think that they would really enjoy it, but let's just say for a cut rate price of about $5,000, you can go to, for instance, Cape Canaveral, Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Las Vegas, Nevada, or Oakland, California. And they will put you on board, after some training, a Boeing 727. And then you will be able to experience almost a minute, or it's somewhere in the range of 1 minute of zero G. So you're in the cabin, and this is how they train astronauts, and this is how they filmed, for instance, Apollo 13, and all those scenes in which Tom Hanks is going between the lunar module and the Apollo capsule. This was in the zero G, many, many different flights on the Vomit Comet. And it's called that because the natural reaction of your inner ear is to make you feel very nauseous in your first experience with zero G. But if you want to have as close to a outer space experience as possible, you can sign up for the Vomit Comet or Zero G and have some fun.
Awesome. And if you're really into this, if you're someone like Dennis Tito who wants to actually get yourself out of the atmosphere and into space, and Dennis Tito spent $20 million to do just that, to spend some time on the International Space Station. There is a company that wants to cater to your needs. It's called Space Adventures. They have different sorts of experiences you can do, including some of those atmospheric ones like the Vomit Comet. But they also are advertising that they can take you at some point around the moon, and also just having some orbital experiences, including a spacewalk. Melissa, I would love to be, or maybe I wouldn't love to be, the lawyer trying to work out the releases for this kind of travel. What do you think?
Well, there are releases going to be required. They're already required just for even suborbital space tourism. So obviously for orbital, it would be much more serious. So I think you can expect that.
Right. All right. Well, whether you're enjoying our show from up in orbit or down here on the terrestrial plane, we appreciate that you've been able to join us for this very out of the world episode of This Week in Law. I so appreciate our guests taking the time to join us. I hope we can get this group back together to reconvene, because I feel like even though we've been at this for almost 90 minutes, there's way more we could talk about here. So I'm hoping that we can get your schedules to cooperate and get you all back again. But for now, we'll have to bid a sad but thankful farewell to Melissa Force. Great meeting you, Melissa.
You too. It was fun.
And Rob Frieden.
Likewise, thanks.
And Larry Martinez.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
I'll go around one more time. If I know, Melissa, you are working on a book on some of the topics we've been discussing here. Can you tell us what it's called and what it's going to cover?
Well, the title hasn't exactly been settled on, but it's basically on the main subject that I was talking about earlier, active debris removal, or ADR, and specifically the non-consensual removal of a bad space actor, somebody who is acting in bad faith or with nefarious intentions. because it's a big issue now, because under the commonly held interpretation of the Outer Space Treaty, once, as Larry, I think, mentioned earlier, and Rob as well, once you launch something, you own it forever, which means that if anybody else wants to interfere with it, no matter if you're using it for wrongful purposes, you still have to get their consent and approval to interfere with it, which of course is probably not going to happen. So my book is on a legal theory in order to enable us to do that.
Wonderful. We're looking forward to that. Good luck with the writing. Rob, we know you were just in attendance at the World Radio Communication Conference. Are there any conferences on topics that you think would be of interest to our listeners coming up at Penn State or otherwise on your radar?
Well, I am paying a lot of attention to mostly terrestrial things these days, but if I had to sort of identify one thing, and it's not really on the rubber chicken circuit just yet, but it will be, that is something called the Internet of Things. And we had a brief mention about these very small CubeSats. They, in a sense, are sensors, no pun intended, and we're going to see sensors on our bodies, in low Earth orbit, on highways, you name it. And there's going to be more of an Internet of machines than there will be an Internet of people. And how these machines interact with algorithms and with people has many, many legal, unresolved legal issues, as well as the possibility of enhancing the human experience. We'll just have to wait and see.
That's right. And Larry Martinez, anything you want to let our folks know about before we wrap it up and get out of here today?
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing Rob at the Pacific Telecommunications Conference in Honolulu. And that's in January. And for many reasons, it's very well attended, especially by people on the East Coast. But basically what Rob was talking about, the Internet of Things, is opening a huge, huge, big area of international politics and law with respect to how do we govern cyberspace, and particularly what I'm looking at is how do we govern outer space as cyberspace increasingly intrudes on the area of outer space. And what we're finding, for instance, is that hackers can take over cars, and because the cars are linked to satellite systems, it's possible for a hacker to take control of an Internet of a thing, that thing being a car. And as, for instance, Google and other companies develop self-driving cars that are in all likelihood going to be linked through space, through satellites for navigation, for communications and so forth, is that what we're seeing is an attempt to govern this whole new area of technological development. And it's going to be a very fascinating ride. And so I'm looking forward to following the evolution of space law from the hard law of the treaties to soft law as we contend with an increasingly growing commercial marketplace.
Yes, absolutely. And again, we're going to have you all on again to keep monitoring this as it goes forward. If you joined us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, that means that you joined us live. That would be 1900 UTC this time of year. And that is when we record this show every single Friday of the year, except for when we're going to take some breaks for the holidays coming up here soon. We hope that you will join us live. If you can, you can jump into IRC with us and interact during the show. But don't worry if you can't. Our entire archive of shows is available for you at twit.tv/twill. You'll find this show and our other space law panel and much else there to interest you, I hope. You should get in touch with me and my co-host, Sarah, between the shows. Sarah will be back after the first of the year, but if you need to reach her or me at any time, you can email us. She is Sarah P. at Sarah P. at twit.tv, and I am Denise at twit.tv. You can also find us on Twitter and on Google+ and on Facebook. The show has pages on both those platforms, and any one of those ways is a great way to let us know what you've thought of this episode or other episodes of the show, other topics that you'd like to see us cover, other guests you'd like to see us invite on. We'd love to hear from you on all of that stuff. So please do be in touch between the shows. And next week, we've got a great panel of our intern, Emery Roan, and some colleagues of his. He's also an intern with New Media Rights. We've had those folks on the show before. They'll be coming back next week. And that'll be our last show before the holidays. So we hope that you make it. And we're thrilled you could join us today for This Week in Law. Take care.